Are you tired of feeling tired? Do you wish you could turn back the clock on aging? NT-Factor Lipids is the breakthrough supplement that's scientifically proven to repair and renew your body's cells. NT-Factor Lipids are identical to the phospholipids found in your cellular membranes. They've been shown to repair mitochondrial damage, a primary cause of biological aging. In clinical trials, NT-Factor therapy resulted in a 26.8% increase in mitochondrial function, restoring it to levels found in young adults. NT-Factor has also been shown to reduce fatigue by up to 43% and has even been shown to significantly reduce a wide range of symptoms and improve the quality of life in patients with various conditions like chronic fatigue and those undergoing chemotherapy. I've been using NT-Factor for years and prescribe it for my patients. You can find the NT-Factor line of nutritional formulas at your favorite health food store or online retailer. Or, to order direct, call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're going to tackle a subject that is very, very germane to both mental and physical health. We're going to talk about addiction to social media. And this is actually an issue that we tackled with today's guest. He wrote a book about the effects on our kids of digital obsessions. That came out in 2016. The book was called Glow Kids. Today, he's back with a brand new book entitled Digital Madness, How Social Media is Driving Our Mental Health Crisis and How to Restore Our Sanity. Dr. Carderas is a psychologist. He's one of the country's foremost addiction and mental health experts. He has previous book is Glow Kids, How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids and How to Break the Trance. Former professor at Stony Brook Medicine. And he's developed treatment programs all over the country. He's written for all manner of media, Time Magazine, Scientific American, Salon, Psychology Today. He's appeared on TV, Good Morning America, ABC's 2020, CNN, CBS Evening News, PBS, NPR, Fox and Friends, and an Esquire and Vanity Fair. And he has a soon-to-be-published op-ed in the New York Post, and it relates to something very topical, which is the savage attack on Peter Pelosi, the husband of the Speaker of the House, and how social media may have had an impact on our epidemic of violence and impulsivity in this country. So, Dr. Carderas, it's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me back, Dr. Hoffman. Always a pleasure to be here.
Indeed. So how did you come to focus on addiction? Because in the book, you actually disclose that you have an interesting past and a near-death experience.
Yes, I do have a couple of chapters in my life. I have a chapter one and a chapter two. It's my own struggles. As many people who get involved in either the mental health field or the addiction field sometimes have to go through their own struggles. And that was true in my case. Post-college, I developed a pretty bad addiction. I was working in New York in the hospitality industry in between graduate school and got swallowed up by a pretty bad addiction. And
we kind of know what the hospitality industry in New York looked like in the 80s and 90s. So one can only imagine the perils to which you were exposed.
Yeah, this was sort of the Gordon Gekko, Rudy Giuliani, Wall Street sort of, it was the period where excess is best, and it was definitely pre-political correctness, and it was the Wild West in Lower Manhattan. And so being a young kid from Queens, I was sort of a kid in the cookie jar, and I got caught up in things that I thought I would be able to manage, and eventually I learned firsthand about how overwhelming addiction can be and how destructive it can be. And it really, really did almost end my life, because I did wind up comatose and on life support. This is before they had some of the fancier, Narcan and other interventions. And you know, as part of that process, I, when I did eventually get into the recovery process and clean and sober, you do go through inevitably a metamorphosis in a human alchemical process, and went back to graduate school and wanted to devote my life to helping other people who were struggling. And initially the doorway for me, as I became an addictions, first I got my clinical social work degree, then my PhD in psychology, was working with people with substance addiction, and really tripped into this issue with process addictions, or, you know, screen addictions and non-substance addictions about a dozen years ago, almost by chance, because I was working with young people and saw the new flavor of compulsive self-destructive behavior. So I was a card-carrying recovery addict myself, who was now a trained clinician, and I was seeing, let's call it, the new evolution of habituation.
So what seemed like a terrible liability turned into an asset for you, because you really had personal experience of this, and used that along with your academic foundation to provide more empathic and insightful care for people who, like yourself, fell into patterns of addiction.
Yeah, and that's part of the recovery process. And thank you, yeah, Ron, that's exactly what happened. And it was part of the recovery process is you begin to understand that perhaps you're not leaving, you know, there's a void. And a lot of people who suffer with any kind of self-medicating behavior feel some sort of a void, whether that void is an existential void or a mental health issue. And so inevitably one has to find a life of meaning and purpose to really kind of push through and no longer sort of be on that self-destructive cycle. And so for me, it was an obvious path. You know, once I started studying, you know, once I immersed myself, not only because I got involved in the 12-step program, that was part of the price of admission for me in my recovery process. You start helping people in the 12-step program, and then you start realizing that there's more paths to helping other people. So for me, that meant going back to school and getting training. And it was understanding that people struggle for a variety of reasons. You know, as I mentioned, you know, some people might be self-medicating because they have unresolved bereavement or depression or just a hole in the soul, as we used to say. And unless you address those underlying issues, there's going to be some propensity to self-medicate. And what I was finding as I kind of entered the doorway of this new generation of, let's call it, digital escapism, a lot of our young people were having early existential crises. They didn't see the meaning or the purpose in their lives, and they were escaping through avatars or synthetic experiences because their own life didn't feel meaningful. And why not escape in that? And when I wrote Glow Kid 6 years ago, I was one of the first people that really began to say, this is an addiction. This is compulsive behavior that isn't just a hobby gone sideways. This was really destroying a lot of young people's academics and personal lives and their health. You know, I write in this book as well as my last book that there's no coincidence between this pediatric obesity epidemic and diabetes and the sedentary screen staring lifestyle that we've not only assumed as adults, as our children are not very healthy, both mentally nor physically. And so when I first started writing about this being an addiction, I got some pushback. Now it's an accepted, you know, the World Health Organization, there's an ICD-11.
They even have it for listeners. There is a book of diagnoses, and the purpose of it is you put in a code and then you get reimbursement, you know, because it is now acknowledged to be a disease, right? And you're treating disease. They've invented a new category, right? Digital addiction.
Right. And it was internet gaming disorder and IGD. But that was a 5-year battle. As you know, many of these the medical bureaucracies are very slow moving. And initially there was a little bit of, no, this is just the problem. I think, Dr. Hoffman, is many people in our generation conflated modern screen time with television. And a lot of us who grew up on television saw it as a fairly innocent pastime. What can go wrong? I grew up on Starsky and Hutch, but you know, what can happen? And I didn't quite appreciate the sophisticated methods by which a lot of behavior modification techniques, the main difference is the immersive and interactive nature of the modern screen time. So when I wrote Glow Kids, it was, oh, wait a second, this is a new potentially habituating thing. It's a new compulsion akin to gambling or any other kind of behavioral addiction like sex. And that was step one. And when I wrote the current book, it was really now step two was, what is this love affair that we as a society have had with our technology? What are the byproducts to our mental health as a result of this? Because when you put essentially a hunter-gatherer species, a species that needs, you know, people go on keto diets because they realize that we still are physiologically hunter-gatherers, but they don't realize that we're also socially and emotionally hunter-gatherers. Mm-hmm. We need the tribe. We need socialization. We need physical activity.
So they eat keto foods while flipping through their Twitter account, you know, exactly. Incessantly. We call it doom scrolling sometimes.
Exactly. So attending to the physiological part, but not realizing that we weren't meant to be sedentary, isolated, screen staring, meaning devoid, empty of people. And so all of a sudden, I was looking at the statistics, and this is right before COVID, and I was noticing the correlation between one step forward for technology, two steps backwards for humanity and our mental health and our physical health. Higher, we were having record rates of suicide and overdose and depression, anxiety at all-time record levels in 2019. We had the highest rates of
even pre-COVID. Over 42. This is before COVID.
Pre-COVID.
Yeah.
Right. We were a psychiatric mess pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. And that correlated with, all you had to do was look at the two corresponding bar graphs. Screen time went up and psychiatric illnesses were going up as well. And then there was research that was connecting it more. There's been quite a few really, really sound peer-reviewed studies that looked at the depression effects, more social media equal more depression. That can make sense because if you're not connecting with people face-to-face and you're in front of a screen, we are hardwired to need face-to-face interaction. So started noticing a lot of the mental health effects, but then also started noticing a lot of the more insidious, let's call them shaping effects of social media. Started seeing a lot of young people who were following not only toxic influencers, like let's call it the Kardashian, Kylie Jenner world of influencers, where they're creating toxic materialistic values for people. But now they're really prominent, psychiatrically unwell influencers, TikTok Tourette's and people who have millions of followers who have borderline personality disorder or who have not only dissociative, there's a whole subculture of DID, dissociative identity disorder, which we used to call multiple personality disorder.
Right. And the three faces and the of Eve, is, that kind of thing. Yeah, right.
And in Three Faces of Eve and Sybil, historically, genuine multiple personality disorder, sexual trauma in childhood, and 3, 4, 5, 6 multiple identities to, you know, alters were created to escape the reality of the untenable sexual abuse that had happened. But now you are having what I'm calling pseudo dissociative disorder, performative dissociative disorder, where you have people who are online with alleging to have over 100 alter identities. And the interesting social contagion aspect that's happening is their followers are now beginning to have multiple personalities. Or the other big one is gender dysphoria. I know this is that's a particularly provocative one, but there's no other way to explain the spike, 1,000% spike in gender dysphoria over the last several years. And then there's no other explanation for such a drastic, this is not just social acceptance of people who have gender dysphoria, wouldn't explain the 1,000% increase in gender dysphoria. But what we're seeing is that it's become part of this subcategory of influencers who are shaping, let's call them young people who are looking for identity or looking for a sense of connectivity. And now they're consciously or unconsciously, I believe, mimicking some of this behavior that they're seeing online.
So you summed it up in a very pithy quote. You say, "I freely concede that we have achieved wondrous advancements in our technological abilities, but our species is deteriorating. We're getting weaker, both physically and mentally." And I think that's at the core of your book, is the detrimental effects of all this media consumption, but also mm-hmm. the concerted efforts to give us devices and to create programs and software and algorithms that reel us in and keep us captivated in order to monetize our encounters.
Right. Right. I think that was also an underappreciated aspect of it that people who grew up on television didn't understand, right? Anybody who grew up in the 50s, 60s, or 70s and grew up on jingles for commercials or radio commercials or TV commercials, they all had their hooks or there was a psychology of advertising, you know, going back for decades. But what we're seeing is behavior modification 2.0, algorithm-fueled techniques that are really insidious, because the what I find really troubling is this isn't just marketing to kids or to adults. This is the algorithms, the way that they're designed right now is, you know, I call them heat-seeking missiles that are really primed for vulnerability, because what big tech has realized is that people can't stop looking at things that are, you know, that tickle our lizard brain, that are, that affect us on an emotional level.
Mm-hmm. It's like rubbernecking. There's a lot of rubber, you know, it's like the cars slow down because, you know, there's bloody bodies on the sidewalk and, you know, a burning vehicle. There's a natural tendency to do that.
Right. So now we're digitally rubbernecking, right? Because we can't stop it. Look, but if you're an unhealthy, so if you're already struggling with an eating disorder and you're an adolescent female and you're rubbernecking some anorexia content, it happens to exacerbate your anorexia, unfortunately. And that's been proven. If you're struggling with depression and now you're rubbernecking suicide content, and that's the problem, the algorithms now realize that somebody is struggling within a particular arena, and now they bombard them with a feedback loop of ever more and more toxic content, which only inflames their underlying issue. Now, this is true for psychiatric disorders, and as I write in this op-ed, it's also true for the politically unhinged. If someone leans a particular way politically or ideologically, and the algorithm, again, the cold soulless AI driven algorithm senses what predisposition a person has. They know that to maintain engagement, they call it an extremification loop. They have to increase the intensity of whatever that person's interested in to maintain engagement, or else a person gets bored and they'll eventually drift off of that content.
But it's also a lot of confirmation bias, because
it's exactly what it is.
It reinforces that. Yeah.
Right. It's confirmation bias on steroids in an echo chamber, 24/7 with sleep deprivation. And, you know, I talk in the book about people's psychological immune systems being compromised. You know, historically, your parents and my parents were raised in a certain way that helped strengthen their psychological immune system. I don't know if you were raised by wolves or if you had a healthy, normal family, but historically, the nuclear family and some of these, there was a tethering and there was a sense of support, because I'm a big believer that a big antidote to a lot of the issues of modernity go back to, not only I talk about ancient philosophy, because I'll get into that in a moment, but just in terms of their lifestyle, that there were more, you know, that's why there were blue zones, right? When you look at what are the common denominators in blue zones, longevity zones, where people tend to live for long periods of time, one of the main common denominators is strong interpersonal relationships. And if you look at what the digital has done to our interpersonal relationships, rare is the person that has, you know, a tightly knit group of close friends that they see on a regular basis. And we need that. We need that. And I think that underlies a big part of the depression epidemic that we're having. We've lost that sense of community. But there's also critical thinking and the clarity that, you know, I write in the book about my father. He was a World War II era Greek immigrant. And, you know, folks from that generation, as, you know, sometimes we'll look at the past dismissively and they didn't get it or whatever, but there was a clarity of thought and there was a common sense and the critical thinking that, I hate to say it, but as you know, because I was a university professor for 10 years, is increasingly less and less common to find common sense. And now you're having this, for lack, you know, some people like NYU professor, the author of The Coddling of the American Mind, oh God, I'm drawing a blank on his name right now, talked about the last 10 to 15 years, the fragility, the emotional reactivity of a lot of young people. And I think social media has essentially created that fragility, that reactivity.
What's interesting about what you're saying is that you don't have to be diagnosed with a clinical psychiatric disorder, bipolar disorder, depression, you know, generalized anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, but we're all affected at some level. And you point out that this change in our media environment is likened to enhancing something called borderline personality disorder. Can you explain what that is from a psychiatric standpoint and how that might be, you know, that we might now all be suffering from subclinical borderline personality disorder?
Yeah. So as I said earlier, I was one of the first people that was sort of eating my popcorn and looking at the social landscape 6-7 years ago and saying, oh, this looks sort of like addiction out there. These teenagers on their phones looks like something akin to, because it was meeting all the diagnostic criteria of substance addiction. Fast forward 6 years later, I'm looking at the social landscape again and young people in the way, I have a treatment program in Austin, Texas, where we specialize in 17 to 30 year olds with dual diagnosis and psychiatric disorders. And we were seeing this large spike in personality disorders and specifically borderline personality disorder. And one of the main symptoms, or one of the main diagnostic criteria of BPD was extreme black and white thinking that leads to a lot of emotional reactivity and binary thinking, right? Yeah. So there was an inability to see things in nuance or the grays. Either everything was either black or white, love or hate, red or blue, and anything in between would lead to sort of an emotional breakdown. And so there was this sort of, and what I began to speculate as I was looking at our social landscape and our political landscape was that we were getting increasingly binary thinkers as a society. And then I started looking at the digital world that we live in, which is extremely binary. The coin of the realm in social media and any digital platform is extreme. It's extremity. Nothing gets views or followers that, you know, thoughtful discourse of two adults talking is not going to get 100 million views on TikTok.
Right. Just go on. Just go on Twitter. You could, you know, put your hazmat suit on and wade into Twitter. And that is
that's right.
Writ large all over Twitter, no matter what the issue.
Right. And you can't be nuanced with 144 characters just by nature of the platform.
Yeah.
So I was beginning to hypothesize that the, you know, McLuhan had said that the medium is the message, that the new medium, this binary medium, was perhaps changing the architecture of the way that especially younger people process information into sort of binary sorting mechanisms that in the same way that in linguistic determinism, there was this theory that language shapes thinking. Now it was beginning to look like our digital media was shaping the way that we think. And again, going back into this binary polarity we're, I think, roughly probably around the same age. I've never seen the political climate as we've always had opposing sides of a political aisle, but the extreme nature of what's happening seems to be both a byproduct of this societal schism that's happening, and then the amplification of this this echo chamber, this feedback loop of this confirmation bias that we were talking about, and so that's happening to all of us to some degree, but the more unhealthy, and that's why I talked about the Paul Pelosi attacker, if you're already a little bit not that stable mentally and you fall into one of these rabbit holes, you're going to come out even more unwell and more extremified, if that's a word, than before.
That's a perfect storm. Okay, a good point of us to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts, and we have a lot more to discuss, including your upcoming op-ed in the New York Post. By the time many of our listeners listen to this podcast, it's likely they will have read it or will have access to it. It's entitled Social Media Madness, and it lays out the case that the current violence politically, including the attack on Paul Pelosi, was in some ways stoked by our current digital media. The book is Digital Madness, How Social Media is Driving Our Mental Health Crisis and How to Restore Our Sanity. We're going to take a look at some possible solutions in part two, our guest, Dr. Nicholas Carderis. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.